welcome to the third day's broadcast at RadioFreeErica.net. Today is Wednesday, August 26th. It's the day after the opening of the Watch What We Say exhibition. And I just wanted to talk about the opening a little bit and thank everyone who came out last night for showing up. It was a lively opening, great show. And for me, who's been in my apartment figuring out tech stuff for a week and broadcasting for a few days, it was really nice to get out. So today, I'm broadcasting again from home, Avenue K, Brooklyn, New York. I'm in what's soon to be my son, Dove's. Well, he is my son. He's not soon to be my son. It's what is soon to be his room. And right now it makes a gorgeous little mock radio sound station. So it's sunny, partly cloudy in New York. The school down the street has started its bell system again, which is just another thing that makes it feel like fall around here. Every 40 minutes or so, the bell's ringing to toll for the period change. My son just woke up. I heard him as I was popping on the headphones. I heard him waking up, and his grandma Carol, who's kind enough to look after him while I'm doing this radio show, she took him downstairs, so they're going to eat some noodles for lunch. And what we're going to be doing on the radio show today is we're going to be talking to a couple of the artists in the exhibition. The artist James Timone, who has a painting up in the exhibition, and the artist Jim Costanzo, who has a video work in the exhibition. But pretty soon we'll be calling James to talk to him about his work and specifically the piece that's in the show. Shortly after that, we'll be calling David Adams, the brother of Mary Adams, who we've been calling in every day from to her dress shop on the Lower East Side to get her observations of just what's going on in the city in relation to the Republican National Convention and the upcoming elections, just sort of what she's observing, and also sort of what is coming through her radar in relation to what she's listening to and reading, those sorts of things. After we talk to David Adams, so he's Mary's brother, but he is also one of the finalists in the Bush in 30 Seconds video open call that MoveOn.org did, and his piece is Bankrupt. So if you want to watch that online, maybe before he comes on, so you have an idea of what he's talking about, it's just a short, it's 30-second piece that he did in collaboration with Adam Klugman. We'll be talking to him. He's in Portland, Oregon. I believe he's just outside of Portland. We'll ask him. He'll let us know specifically where he is. Then we'll be talking to Wade about his commute from Greenpoint, Brooklyn to FIT. Then we'll be talking to the artist Jim Costanzo about his piece in the Watch What We Say exhibition, as well as his history of political activism and art making. And then we'll be talking to Mary Adams at the end. So I wanted to start today with, well, first an announcement. If you were at the Watch What We Say exhibition, you perhaps got the beautiful newspaper that Ann Messner designed. It's in the vending machine in the exhibition. And tonight is the Unconventional Heroes, an evening of performance to honor courageous resistors. And it's being presented by the Artist Network of Refuse and Resist and sponsored by the NYU chapter of the National Lawyers Guild. And it is tonight, the 26th, at 7:30 p.m. at the Skirball Center for the Performing Arts at 566 LaGuardia Place at Washington Square South. So the thing I have here says the tickets are limited. If you want to phone for tickets, it's 212-992-8484. And there's also more information at www.artistsnetwork.org. And tonight they'll be honoring resistors Aaron Leibowitz, a student in Montana who led others against the teaching of creationism in school. Tony Smith, a basketball player who turned her back on the U.S. flag to protest the war on Iraq. The parents of Rachel Corey, who was murdered while trying to prevent the demolition of a Palestinian home. Michael Berg, who responded to the beheading of his son Nick in Iraq by demanding an end to all violence around the world. Jason West, the mayor of New Paltz, who faced criminal charges for marrying gay and lesbian couples, Aaron McGruder, the Boondocks creator, and many more. So it's hard for me to even just read this. It's so emotional thinking about all of these people. So that's tonight at 7:30 at the Skirball Center for the Performing Arts. And then I also just wanted to read a short piece by Gertrude Stein. It's at the end of her book, Bruzy and Willie. And sort of like a after the book bit. And it's called Two Americans. GIs and GIs and GIs. They have made me come all over patriotic. I was always patriotic. I was always in my way a Civil War veteran. But in between, there were other things. But now, there are no other things. And I'm sure that this particular moment in our history is more important than anything since the Civil War. We are there where we have to have a fight, a spiritual pioneer fight, or we will go poor as England and other industrial countries have gone poor. And don't think that communism or socialism will save you. You just have to find a new way. You have to find out how you can go ahead without running away with yourselves. You have to learn to produce without exhausting your country's wealth. You have to learn to be individual and not just mass job workers. You have to get courage enough to know what you feel and not just all be yes or no men. But you have to really learn to express complication. Go easy, and if you can't go easy, go as easy as you can. Remember the Depression. Don't be afraid to look at it in the face and find out the reason why. Don't be afraid of the reason why. If you don't find out the reason why, you'll go poor. And my God, how I would hate to have my native land go poor. Find out the reason why. Look for facts in the face, not just what they all say, the leaders, but every darn one of you, so that the government by the people for the people shall not perish from the face of the earth. It won't. Somebody else will do it if we lie down on the job. But all the things don't stop. But of all things, don't stop. Find out the reason why of the Depression. Find it out, each and every one of you, and then look the facts in the face. We are Americans. So that's by Gertrude Stein, and it's at the end of the Bruzy and Willie book that she wrote after working with GIs in France during the Second World War. I think another day I'll read a little bit from the actual book itself as well, but I wanted to start with that today, set the mood. All right, so let's give James a call.
Thank you for calling Bayard Advertising. If you...
Thank you. One moment, please.
It's funny calling everyone.
This is James. Can I help you?
Hey, James. It's Erica.
Oh, hi, Erica. How are you?
Hi, I'm good. How are you? We're on the air.
Right now?
Right now.
Okay. What's going on?
Well, what's going on? I don't know. We're on the air. And I'm calling to ask you about your artwork.
Oh, well, thank you for calling.
Mm.
It's a real pleasure.
Well,
it was quite an opening, too, I thought.
Yeah, well, what was your experience of the opening?
Well, I mean, it was a friendly bunch, and it seemed like a steady, good crowd came through the whole time. So that was, I think, more than could be hoped for. So why not?
Yeah. No, it was. It was a really nice group of people who came through, and we have studios in that same space, so it was interesting also, like, to see new faces.
Right,
you know?
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I was quite happy with the whole thing, I guess. I guess it was a lot more artsy than I thought it would be,
uh-huh.
And maybe a little bit less political than I also expected. But
so, what do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, it seemed like it was as much of an art interested crowd, and not like a dead on political crowd that was, you know, or activist crowd that was out to make a statement. As much as people seemed like they were a lot more down to earth and respectful,
mm-hmm.
And you know, just really everyone seemed focused and attentive, you know, and it was just like continuing like the hard work that everyone does, you know. So not that activists don't do that also, but it was nice to see the mix of the two,
right,
in a way that was that just seemed solemn in a way, even though it was fun. It was serious too.
Right. Inclusive is that like that's something that comes to mind in terms of, I feel like a lot of times like the art world can feel exclusive as well as the activist world can feel exclusive, and it was sort of the two coming together, and it felt somehow inclusive.
Exactly. I thought so too.
Yeah. So a lot of people have been saying very positive things about your painting in the exhibition, and I don't know if that's come back to you as well, or.
Oh yeah, it was very positive, and you know, I was more than happy. I talked to a lot of people about it last night too. So.
Oh, that's great. People you didn't know already?
Yeah, I mean, quite a few people that I was introduced to, or that just introduced themselves to me, and the response overall seemed, you know, seemed very positive, and you know, that's always what I guess you're hoping for. So. You know, I guess that's basically why you put it out there in the first place. So, you know, so that you get, you know, so that you communicate to other people and just hear what they have to say back. And, you know,
exactly.
That's the whole point.
Go
ahead.
Can you describe the painting a little bit? Is that,
Well, it's a painting I wanted to do for quite a while. It's just a couple. It's a relatively dead on figurative painting. I don't know if I'd exactly call it traditional, but it's a straight-up portrait of two mounted New York City police officers, you know, and their horses. And it's a relatively solemn, you know, dark painting. It's not particularly flashy, I don't think. But I guess it ends up being just a portrait of the two policemen, you know, rendered in a relatively traditional manner, and there's, you know, not much more to it than that. At least, you know, if you're just looking at the dead-on surface of the thing, you know,
right.
that's basically. It's an eyeful, though. You know, it's a heavy looking painting, and I think it's relatively. I mean, I hope it's heavy in terms of meaning and you know, just the initial impression that it gives off.
Well, okay, the language of painting is not my language,
mm-hmm.
my mother tongue, but anyway,
right.
they kind of melt in and out of the background,
mm-hmm.
also. So it's the two of them, in the painting is like very much that NYPD blue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not sure. I don't think that there's any real symbolism to the, you know, to the choice of colors in the thing. They're not, you know, I didn't think about it too much in terms of you know, the kind of symbolic meaning that might be associated with particular colors of blue, except in the terms of the helmets, which just grabbed me from the moment I started photographing them. I've actually been staring at these cops on horses for a couple of years, but when I started photographing them, that was really when I noticed that their helmets are this lighter shade of blue, and it's almost the only incidence of that light shade of blue in any of the graphics of the NYPD or any of their uniforms. It's almost the only instance of that particular shade of blue, and I thought that was pretty fascinating, because that lighter blue is it seems to me like it's particularly loaded, you know, symbolically, but I'm not really using it, you know, to symbolize anything else other than the NYPD, but I did emphasize it quite a lot in the painting and, and put it in some other places where it's not naturally or wouldn't be in, you know, in the real world, but I kind of got a pretty curious about the fact that those helmets were that shade of blue. And really, as much as anything, that is just a way that I've used to kind of meditate on the nature of power and beauty, and the way that the two mix up in that particular you know, that image of mounted police, you know, that are used for crowd control, and that end up doing so much public relations work on behalf of the NYPD. And I think that's just a fascinating question to turn around in my head.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the fact that they're beautiful, and that people will just instantly, tourists just immediately walk right up to those cops because of their horses,
mm-hmm.
and I think are always impressed by the beauty of this animal, you know, and that kind of seductive quality of, you know, these particular police officers is really what I'm kind of fascinated by, if not, you know, outrightly seduced myself. So, I mean, I guess that's the lowdown on the painting, and then the question I'm asking over and over again is what is it about this particular thing that is so seductive,
mm-hmm.
you know, and this kind of power that is so seductive.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I don't think that it's something that I'll answer easily, and I don't, you know, if at all, but it's certainly a question that keeps me asking it over and over again. That's pretty much the extent of what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
It's just asking that question.
And do you feel like that's the kind of, that's the way you work in general? Like, not specifically just with this imagery, but, I'm thinking of your airplane painting.
Exactly.
Also.
Yeah, I mean, I do think it's, what I'm interested in is the kind of imagery that just seduces over and over and over again, because, and maybe seduce isn't the right word all the time, but it's more like the kind of imagery that keeps you looking at it without really having a good reason to look at, you know, or what we would typically think of as a good reason. You know, you're not just getting information, but you're looking merely for the sake of looking in some cases. And sometimes I think that it's, and very often I think it's more than you're just looking for the sake of looking, but actually looking becomes a reverential or maybe a, you know, some kind of more significant act that I do think is close to a kind of reverence. And, you know, and I think that is just an important part of what our experience should be like or could be like. And if you have that experience more, I think it's you know, it makes for a better experience of the world generally.
I guess I was also thinking about gender in relation to the paintings. I don't know if you think about that or you try. I mean, how much you feel like that's conscious or unconscious, or
did you say gender?
Yeah, gender. I mean, I think both the cops on horses and the airplanes, I mean, there's this, in our culture at least, they're kind of boys' toys, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I was just curious if that's something that you're interested in or not so interested
in. It's no, I think it's an interest. It's for sure. it's a curious thing, but I don't know that it's something that I can confront very easily in the kind of work I do, although I think it's a legitimate question. I think that as much as anything, what I've always tried to do is communicate that kind of issue to a, you know, to an equally male or female audience, because I think that it is rejected kind of outright for everyone now to some extent, other than in marketing, where I think it's really prevalent. I think that people, that, you know, men as the audience of marketers are definitely subjected to that kind of thinking and that kind of imagistic message that they should do this in a very particular way, but to do it in a reverential way, or in a way that is less just less aggressive and more meaning centered, is actually very much the kind of behavior that's considered, you know, less masculine or actually feminine.
Right.
You know, so that if you're a man who even appreciates something as obvious as architecture, that is considered, you know, a less masculine thing to do. So I try to present any audience with particularly masculine imagery, but the fact, the idea, and the way that it's presented is already, I think, in a kind of a more feminized version of itself. You know, so if, when I did all these paintings of airplanes in particular, you know, so many men were, you know, happy and thrilled with these images, but the very fact that they were paintings that they were interested in, I sold some of those paintings to people, you know, to men in particular who had never bought any other painting at all, you know. So that was what, I mean, I do think it plays a role in it, but it's an odd, confusing kind of, you know, way that it is, that the whole thing works. At least that's the impression that I've gotten of it so far.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but it's not at the forefront of what I'm thinking about, really.
Right.
I don't think that, you know, I can talk about gender in other ways, I think, a lot better. But when it comes to the paintings themselves, I think that the questions tend to be more, you know, they're just of a different nature than what, you know, what lend themselves to some of the hotter topics in the art world right now, because they are relatively traditional paintings. I mean, they also get accused of just being patriarchal, you know, old school patriarchal paintings.
I think for people who want to make accusations, you can find anything.
Yeah, of course. I mean, certainly.
For any medium.
Yeah, absolutely. It's always interesting, because I think a lot of what I try to do is present paintings that are really easily accessible for a lot of people that don't look at art a lot, you know, and usually I'm in, or at least frequently, I find myself in the context of people who are doing things in non-traditional mediums, you know, with the same intent.
Mm-hmm.
And so it always makes for an interesting kind of juxtaposition, because I like to do contemporary subject matter, you know, in a much older medium.
Mm-hmm.
And so, whereas I think what people are, a lot of other people are doing is doing traditional subject matter, but in a, you know, a really up-to-date or a really, you know, cutting-edge kind of medium, like,
right,
you know, textual printouts and things like that, you know,
right,
that are really anti-medium.
Right. It's interesting. And so, and I guess one of my questions also is, I mean, that process, like how you came to painting.
Change it? Is that what you said?
No, how you came to painting, like what your path has been as an artist. Like,
mm-hmm. I guess I started out more as a physical, a much more physically working sculptor, and I had to do, for a long time, I had to do really, really very exhausting kinds of physical work that eventually I just kind of tired myself out on building and constructing big things. And I learned a way to just relatively carefully put that same kind of effort and attention into painting that also started out very physical and very big and, you know, very aggressive. But it's just kind of, it's been a process. It's really very simple, like in the sense that it's just been a process of slowly unlearning all of the kind of aggressive behavior that, you know, aggressive kind of activity that I used to do in order to, like, bang out some kind of angry art. Even though, you know, a lot of that energy and sensibility I still think is there, but it's in a much more controlled way than it used to be.
Yeah, it's so interesting.
Yeah. I mean, it's been a long road, for sure.
Yeah.
But somehow I let the materials, you know, I can still, like, tell when they're actually containing that same energy, you know, and that's when I paint really well.
Uh-huh.
You know. But it's not been so terrifically a mental process or, like, a decision, you know, that I one day made, you know, I was going to decide to...
Right.
To be a painter, you know, I've always done it with almost a sense of resignation that, you know, well, now I've got to do it this way. You know, just as a result of learning, like, how bad most of my ideas are and how bad my decisions are, you know, if it was all up to me, I would be an accountant or something like that, you know, but luckily I'm not. So.
You're an accountant that paints.
Yeah, I mean...
or a painter that accounts.
It would have been a real disaster, I think, if I had ended up, obviously I've made, like, lots of other decisions that haven't been so great, but the one thing that I always kind of fell back on was this one thing that I didn't have much choice in, and that was painting. So, I mean, that's what I mean by resignation, as much as, you know, the kind of not wanting to do it, because it's only rarely now like that, you know, that I feel like it's something I don't want to do.
Mm-hmm.
So there's not a lot of regret in my background either, you know.
Well, do you feel like in the current political climate or since September 11th, like, do you feel different senses of urgency for subject matter or within yourself?
I think that there's two answers to the question, and in a sense, I think that there is a tremendous political importance to doing work like that, as I think there is to doing work like painting or poetry, or acting or anything that is creative and proactive. But I don't necessarily. I think the point of all that is that those things, when they're done right, have a political importance and an impact that is real. But I also think that that kind of importance is so much bigger and more important than all of us that I don't think it should be necessary. I try not to mix it into what I consider, like, the everyday politics of living and life. And in that other side of life, I think that there is tremendous urgency since September 11th or since, you know, since the turn of the last century or whatever. I mean, I think there is a real field of politics that we're all engaged in and that everyone should be engaged in more and where we can do, like, tremendously other important work. But to mix the two up is almost like mixing church and state in a way in that we've got to take politics very seriously, but at the same time, we've got to not take ourselves taking politics quite as seriously as we take ourselves with painting or with poetry, which is, you know, at least, which I think is actually more important that we, in spite of everything, maintain, you know, the kind of mentality that it takes to create things independently of the world around us, you know, because we don't really understand how what we do that way affects what's going on in the world around us. Whereas there's some really obvious political decisions that we need to all make and address and have control over, you know, and do the best that we can in that field. But we can't really control, you know, what this particular poem is about or this particular painting is about. And that's what makes, you know, those kinds of hyper-political things, like you know, the art's so much more important, is that ultimately I think there's a different kind of wisdom in there that we have to be really careful about how we approach it. And, you know, and what I'm saying is, in some sense, we have to keep those things alive, like in spite of everything else that's going on. But, yeah, for sure, I mean, I know there's a total urgency in what I consider, like, the mundane politics of everyday life, you know, that we have to take extremely seriously, too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I hope it doesn't sound like too evasive of an answer to the question.
No, it's an interesting answer to the question.
It's a complicated world, you know, and
I think it's, you know, part of what's so exciting for me getting to do this is it's hearing how other artists, like, hearing their process.
Yeah.
And I think it's inspiring and very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody does it differently.
Yeah. Well, this radio thing certainly seems like it could be a great part of the whole, you know, that whole process, you know, especially on the, you know, not to call that mundane, but this is another big part of what we're all doing, you know, that is like real politics, and that's, you know, it's always been as important to me as anything else I do, you know, as anything I do in my studio, you know, because I'm the kind of artist who is obsessed with politics. Even, like, you know, everyday politics, I read about them constantly. And it's not always, like, to the benefit of my studio, you know. Sometimes my studio work suffers because I'm just reading the paper too much, and it's really, like, has nothing to do with what I'm doing in my studio. But at the same time, like, I mean, I think getting back to what your question originally was, you know, the urgency is certainly, like, there because, I mean, half of us can hardly afford, you know, to keep doing what we're doing at all, you know.
I know.
Obviously, like, budgets and policy kinds of questions are like paramount right now.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it starts to feel like the 1930s in a lot of ways, and that's a really dangerous way for it to feel.
No, absolutely. I just read in the beginning a little, I can't think of the word when an author writes at the end of the book. I know there's the prologue, but then what's the
afterword?
Exactly,
yeah.
Thank you. It, by Gertrude Stein, just after,
mm-hmm.
or during the Second World War.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's just, then is now again.
Yeah.
And
yeah, I mean... So. And I think as much a danger as there is in everything like we're reading and thinking about, the bigger part of the danger is that there's so many people who aren't reading anything, you know, or who are just completely unaware of what's going on. And you know, and as much as we can do to like get the word out there a little bit more, you know, even because I mean I honestly think that the focus of this campaign should be on convincing Republicans not to vote for him as much as anything to do with undecided voters. I mean, the idea that people would even, you know, people who don't make, you know, $200,000 a year or more would even consider voting for this guy is just like, I mean, they have to be illiterate at this point because you just have to have missed all of what he's done to be voting against your own interests like that. So, I mean, I don't know if you actually want to talk hard politics. I had to turn down, like, Air America Radio when you called, because I just sit here and listen to it all day at my job.
It's crazy. That's great.
Yeah.
Well, I guess I should say thank you.
I should thank you, really. It's been a real pleasure.
No, it's really, thank you very much for giving of your time.
My pleasure entirely. Now, try and hear some more of the broadcast in the studio or maybe get something going here.
Okay.
Figure out some way of listening to you at work. I'm not sure I can hook up the speakers on my computer, but like I said, I really appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah, thank you. Likewise.
Okay.
All
Erica.
Right, so see you soon.
Okay,
babe.
Take care now. Bye-bye.
Bye.
So that was the artist, James Timone. He is in the Watch What We Say exhibition that opened last night at Schroeder Romero Gallery. Next, we're going to call David Adams in Oregon.
One of the finalists in the MoveOn.org Bush in 30 seconds.
have reached a number that has been...
Try it. Hi, David?
Yeah?
Hi, this is Erica DeVries from New York. We're on the air.
You know what? I'm sorry. It's a really bad connection. I can barely hear you. Can you hear me?
Yeah, you're breaking up, though. Should I try calling again?
No, actually, things are... I'm in my workshop. Let me walk closer to the house and see. I can hear you better now.
Okay.
So, how are you?
I'm well, thanks.
Uh-huh.
Thank you so much for agreeing to talk to me on... the radio.
Yeah, well, I'm pleased to.
Yeah, good. And then I just watched your piece again on at the Move On site.
Uh-huh.
It's great.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, I was hoping you could talk a little bit about what motivated you and Adam Klugman or Klugman?
Klugman.
Klugman to make the piece.
Well, actually, Adam and I have worked together on a number of grassroots political campaigns at a local level here in my little city in Oregon called West Lynn. Adam actually comes from an advertising and Hollywood background. He's a professional editor, and we had actually spent months sort of brainstorming and strategizing and looking for opportunities to sort of play at the national level, and had followed Move On, and both of us sort of received the email announcing their competition at the same time. It was almost comical that, you know, I'm on the horn to him and he's on the horn to me, and we're going, oh, yeah, you're the experience. And as I said, we were sort of looking for an opportunity somehow to sort of move some of the things we've learned in local grassroots elections to a higher level. And, you know, we were looking for any opportunity from state issues to national issues, so we were kind of primed and ready when the competition came up, and very clearly set a strategy. You mentioned you've just seen our piece. Ours was very intentionally designed not to sort of sing to the choir, as it were. It was as clear to us then as it is now that to actually convert, I mean, it's one thing to produce an ad that the, you know, your choir can rally around, and most all of the entries to the Move On thing sort of accomplished that. They were really great at sort of articulating anger or frustration or at the Bush administration, and we sort of took a different strategy, and I guess it probably wasn't correct for what Move On really wanted at that time, but we wanted a piece that could appeal to the swing voter, and I think in that regard we really hit the mark, because we just, you know, 30 seconds isn't a lot of time.
Mm-hmm.
We sort of started with what are the most important issues that we see that this administration has sort of messed up, and I think we had 6 or 8, and then it was a matter of elimination to figure out what could actually fit into our 60-second or 30-second spot. So areas that we wanted to hit, it just became a matter of prioritizing. But as you recall, if you just saw that, we hit unemployment, we hit the national deficit, we hit the war in Iraq, and then we hit on our national credibility. And the ad, I don't know if you caught this, but in the beginning what we wanted was a parody on those famous MasterCard commercials where the son and the dad are at the ball game, and, you know, it says baseball cap, $15, the soft drink, $5, and it ends with, you know, time with your son, priceless, MasterCard. Well, ours is titled Bankrupt, and it sort of ends in the same thing. We hit on these errors that the administration has made, and in the closing line is America's future, bankrupt. Adam did the voiceover. He's got a brilliant voice, comes from theater, and the voiceover, I think, is, and the music, the whole tone, you probably puzzled a little bit over the images. They're definitely vintage images that we Adam owns a number of reels of stock footage that he can use, and we found, I mean, it was amazing because we found those images in about 2 hours of searching, and on each one it was sort of like a major high five. Wow, that's perfect. The image with the women carrying the flag is a 4th of July parade from some who knows where, but that image in particular I think was really a beautiful piece. But so our goal really was to appeal to the swing voters. It wasn't a piece done to rally the troops. There's enough of that going on. You know, even back when we cut this, the philosophy that one of the philosophies we worked with is it's really, really easy to criticize what these people are doing, but to win votes, we've got to be affirmative, and we've got to put a message out there that is palatable to this. What do we figure it is? It's 20% of the American voters that swing around. So that really was our goal, and I think in that regard we really hit. And I think, personally, I think we need to see more of that right now in the national debate. Instead of all this divisiveness, we need to figure out ways to find common ground to pull, to embrace those not-so-radical voters. But so that's the ad, basically, in a nutshell.
Wait, it reminds me of, I was just reading about a newer thing that MoveOn has been doing with a filmmaker whose name I can't remember right now, but it where they've been interviewing people who've changed parties, or that they're still Republicans, but they're going to vote Democrat.
And uh-huh.
It sounds a lot like what you're talking about.
Uh-huh.
You know,
uh-huh.
And sort of the aim of your piece. So maybe you were saying it wasn't their goal at the time with the Bush in 30 seconds, but it seems like it's very much now where
yeah.
they're focusing.
Yeah. Well, you know, thank God for MoveOn and Howard Dean and all those groups that re-energized the whole
yeah.
liberal movement. You know, that was another thing that frustrates me, and I'm sure you and so many other progressive liberals in the United States, how the heck did we become a bad word? How did liberal become a bad idea? You know, when how many years did we listen to nuthead conservatives make fun of altruism and anyone who'd have an interest in advancing social causes? How did that become evil or bad or un-American? I think it's to MoveOn's credit and John Dean, you know, to stand up and say, hey, liberal, I'm proud of it, goddammit. You know, we built this nation. Yes, I'm pleased to see that MoveOn, their flexibility and ability to sort of quickly respond and produce ads that are very sensitive, timely, because that's the key to winning this election now, is being able to respond to all of this attack, like the stupid swift boat captains for dishonor and lies. How long did it take Kerry's camp to respond to those? You know, we're going to lose if we can't respond. We got to play like these guys.
Right.
And it's a hard lesson for liberals, because we have a hard time being dirty. We have a hard time not playing by the rules, you know. And I think, really, right now, there's this irony where, and I can't claim this original thought of mine. I forget the author's name. A brilliant book called Death of a Liberal. And in the opening pages, he mentions how liberals have built this record. I mean, for some reason, we're willing to lose on principle. You follow me?
Right, yes.
You know, I know why, but so what does that mean in this election? Are we going to lose on principle, knowing full well that these guys are going to lie and cheat and steal and scare the daylights out of everybody to win?
Right.
How do we compete against that without becoming like them? I mean, this, I guess, is the real dilemma for the whole progressive movement right now. How do we beat them and not become them in the process?
Well, this sort of leads me to something that I've been thinking about and trying to ask people about, and then Mary said that you have ideas, that this idea of losing on principle or who wins or playing like them, like Mary had said that you have ideas of restructuring or what changes that need to happen within the Democratic Party, and I think there are a lot of people who feel right now that the choices, like there isn't that big of a difference between our choices. So even this idea of losing on principle, or what then? What happens? What happens? Say we get what we want, and Bush loses, and Kerry wins. What then? What do we all do then?
Yeah.
Or vice versa. Bush wins again. Everybody remains really pissed. Then what?
Yeah.
You know.
Well, you know, I would agree with where you started that somewhat there are similarities between the parties, and that is that both of them are corrupt. They're corrupted by big money, and as a liberal Democrat, I'd be lying to myself if I thought that our party is not corrupt. Are we equally corrupt? No, but both parties have the same issue. They've got it a lot worse than we do. But I think what Mary was alluding to in those comments was that what we have to be doing right now, win, lose, or draw in the presidential election, we've got to start rebranding the Democratic Party.
Mm-hmm.
We've got to start standing up and saying, you know, for example, do you work a 40-hour work week? Well, guess who gave that to you? It wasn't the conservatives, it was us. Do your children enjoy a good public education? Well, guess what? Guess who's been fighting that and trying to dismantle it since it was created? Conservatives. I mean, the whole liberal, progressive, whatever you want to call it now, everyone's afraid to say they're liberal, so we're progressive. That whole movement has to be rebranded by following, I think, John Dean's lead of just standing up and identifying all of the benefits that we enjoy today in our society that came on the backs and the blood, sweat, and death of a lot of liberal Americans. And those are all items from women's votes to civil rights that conservatives fought like hell.
Mm-hmm.
So how they become the champions of the American cause is a real mystery. We've got to reclaim that ground, liberals. And to do it, we've got to rebrand the Democratic Party. Examples, I mean, right now there's all this to-do about the 527 political action committees and who can spend what money on what and how much the Democratic Party can spend on candidates. You know, the Democratic Party right now should be using some of those $200 million or whatever they've managed to collect, and they should be running spots right now redefining the party. Take the environment, for example. I mean, why aren't they running spots that sort of show and illustrate how liberal Democrats have been the champion of the whole environmental movement? And education or health care, any one of those things, and help establish again in the minds of Americans who the party really is that's been advancing these agendas, and all of their candidates will benefit from them. I mean, instead of spending all this money on John Kerry, they should spend half of that money on redefining what it is to be a Democrat. Then all of their Democratic candidates, from the smallest state races to the president, benefit from that. Then all of a sudden, we're the party that people want to join. You know, right now people don't want to join the Democratic Party because we've allowed them to define us as limp-wristed, indecisive tree huggers. You know, they define us, we lose. We have to redefine ourselves,
right,
and then define them as who they are, which are greedy, scary, creepy people, by and large.
So, oh my goodness, there's such a great painting in the exhibition that this radio station is running in conjunction with by an artist named Robbie Cannell. Speaking of creepy, scary, it's just a picture of Bush titled "Read My Apocalypse."
Oh, that's brilliant. That's brilliant.
It's fantastic. But so in that idea of rebranding, so what can you talk a bit about? I mean, Mary's told me, but I was hoping you could talk a little bit maybe about another project that you and Adam have done together, sort of those grassroots projects you were talking about, and then maybe what you guys are up to right now. Together or separate.
I'm not certain if I got that question. You want to hear more about our initial foyers into politics?
Yeah, if you could describe one of the other things you've done together.
Yeah.
And then.
Well, let me explain to you the start. West Lynn is a really bustling, growing little suburb in the greater Portland metropolis in Oregon. And our nearest neighbor is Oregon City, which everyone who's got a brain would identify with the end of the Oregon Trail. A lot of the land in and around where I live is some of the very first land the pioneer settlers took when they came here and land claims. So my property, for example, is like in Book 1, Page 2 of Oregon Tax Code. So there's a lot of land here with both First Nation history and a lot of settler history. The area has come under a lot of pressure from development. It's a very desirable place to be, and I sort of watched this city grow from a really pleasant rural community into this sort of your classic American subdivision sort of community where developers run the city council and run the mayor, and I'd sort of had enough of it and decided to try to help foster a new agenda here to slow growth down and to kick the developers out of City Hall. And, you know, so we're battling that classic statement that you can't buck City Hall. Well, I'm here to tell you you can. It just takes determination and a good message and a good cause. Two campaigns in a row, we've succeeded in electing. Every one of our candidates has won, in spite of the Home Building Association out here writing the differential in campaign budgets. I think in each of the last elections, the building community has invested at least $40,000 in the mayor and city council race. And we've managed to raise, the first election, I think we got $8,000. The second one, I think we got $4,000, and we still blew them out of the water. We used very traditional media in unconventional ways. In city council races out here, they're sort of won and lost by yard signs. It's sort of he with the most yard signs wins. So it's always been easy for the building community to their candidates to win just on sheer volume of signs. The other media we used in a slightly different fashion was video, and I'll explain what we did with both. The sign campaign was a really creative effort that ran for about 2 months before the election without really identifying that we had a political cause. And I'll explain. Everyone, I don't know, should know about the Burmashave signs of old, which was advertising that if you're 50 years old or older, you're well aware of Burmashave signs. You would sort of every family vacation, you would sort of pray you might see one or two. And it was poetic. It was three or four signs that told a story or told a joke or told a rhyme, and it always ended with, by Burmashave. We sort of took that message or that approach and applied it to politics and used signs that sort of popped up in our community here and there, and the first one that went up said, like traffic, nothing more than that. Imagine a white yard sign in stencil font in black. So it was made to look like some guy in his basement made it, which it sort of was true. Like traffic. Now, what the heck does that mean? And the sign appeared, and incidentally, anyone who might be listening to this know that this idea you could almost franchise. Like traffic, and I put those signs up everywhere people were stuck in traffic.
Hey, Dave, you're starting to break up again a little bit.
Okay, sorry. those went up everywhere in our community where people were stuck in traffic. And no one could make sense out of it. Like traffic? Does that mean, do I like traffic? Like traffic? No! What does that mean, like traffic? And that sign stayed up and played for a month or so. And then I introduced another sign that said, more houses. On the same font, same kind of signage. And again, it was our curiosity people. People didn't know if that meant that's a company, more houses, and they're going to build houses there. What does that mean, more houses? And this sign I actually used, this was sort of political, architectural art, I forget the phrase for that, landscape art. We've got a lot of beautiful farm fields out here. So imagine one day you're going to work and you see this sign out in the middle of the field says more houses. The next day you show up and there's five of them. The next day you show up and there's 100 of them in this farm field. And it just really grabbed people. And, you know, then they're starting to make a connection that, gosh, is this field going to be full of houses next? And the whole thing was guerrilla campaign. I'd come in at night, 2 in the morning, and put the signs up. And move them the next day to another field and start the whole thing over. And it's, so people are talking now and thinking, who's with those signs and where are they going? The next sign that came up said crowded schools. And I placed that wherever the soccer mom was stuck in traffic after having delivered their kids or picked them up. And they're thinking, crowded schools. And so we've got these three signs playing in different times and different locations around the city. And it's not until I play them together that people finally get the connection. So this is where the Burma Shave comes in. After they'd all played for a while, then I started running them together. So then it's like traffic, crowded schools, more houses. And all of a sudden people are making the connection to growth and their crowded schools and their traffic problems. And it really grabbed people, the whole idea. The building community had no idea what we were up to. And at this point, we still haven't said, we're for these candidates or those candidates. People don't really even know where the movement's going. And that followed with a couple of other messages that all led to the goal of the campaign, and that was control. And we put up signs that ultimately said, first, who controls growth? And then people are thinking, well, not me. I don't control growth. It's, you know, City Hall. It's those builders. Well, the last message before the campaign came up said, you control growth, in Burma Shave style. You control growth. Then people are finally getting it. Then the final sign that went in that series is, you control growth, vote. Then people are going, no, I really get it. Yeah, I do control growth. It was so empowering. People loved it. People, no one out here in West Lynn now believes you can't control growth. They know, yeah, I get it. I control growth by who I elect to city council and the mayor I elect. And it was, it was overwhelming. People here just really loved it. And that idea, anyone that's listening, if you've got a cause, figure out a way to tell your message without really showing your card, capture your electorate's imagination, then play your final card. It was 3 weeks before the election that our signs finally came up that said, save West Lynn, elect David Dodds for mayor, save West Lynn, Michael Capigan for city council. And we blew them out of the water. Double-digit victory.
That's excellent. And I think probably most people that are listening are somehow related to the arts community, and so it might be important to say what you do. I mean, you are not trained as an artist, as far as I know. Is that correct? In what you do for a living. I mean, I think it's even more exciting that you're doing these projects because you are outside of the creative, like the arts community, directly. Can you describe what you do for a living?
For a living, I call myself an automotive archaeologist.
Mm-hmm.
I restore European sports cars. from the 50s and 60s.
My father's going to be calling you.
The archaeology part of this is I have a sort of special niche in auto restoration that people bring me boxes of things that used to be exotic cars. And generally the scenario is the same. They bought this Ferrari or Aston Martin or Jaguar as a young guy, and they had enough knowledge to know how to take something apart. And they usually did that and then realized, I don't have a clue how to get this back together again.
Mm-hmm.
And usually 10, 20, 30 years pass, a divorce or two, you know, these boxes have gone from warehouse to garage to warehouse, and I get what's left. The guys bring me the boxes, and it's usually unmarked. You know, I've had guys bring me cars in baby food jars, which was brilliant. Every
That's
single little
amazing.
Component taken apart and labeled. That's a dream come true. But more times than not, I get boxes of things. And,
That's amazing.
And you know, like the archaeologist with the remains of a broken piece of pottery, you know, you sift through everything you've got and look for clues of how it all goes back together. You know, many cars of this era were one-offs or in a production run of, you know, months, things change substantially. So books really, books are helpful, but it really just takes a lot of ingenuity to figure out and get them all back together again. So currently in my shop right now, I've got a 59 Jag convertible, a 53 Jag convertible, a 67 Lotus Elan, a 67 Ferrari 330 GTC that's about ready to get sold. So
they're all in pieces?
Those are all in the process of coming back together. I actually, I don't have anything in currently that's at the beginning of the process.
Mm-hmm.
So those are all things that are well on the way or ready to be sold or returned to their customers.
That's great. You and Mary are inspiring, both. I guess we just have a couple more minutes left, and so I just wanted to ask you what, if you and Adam are working on any projects right now, or if you...
Yeah, let me tell you. Actually, Adam produced, there was a similar competition that the DNC sponsored for the convention last month for producers or amateurs or anyone to submit an ad to be aired at the national convention. And it was written, Adam wrote it with an upcoming Democratic star here in Oregon by the name of Jefferson Smith.
Mm-hmm.
And they actually won the competition with that one, and they have it on a website that I wish I could tell you how to get to.
Well,
it's a piece that has to be aired. I think the dam's kind of...
Maybe.
It's the most brilliant ad that anyone has produced this whole campaign season.
Oh, that's
and
great.
If the Democrats can't be convinced to buy airtime to air it, Move On has to, because this piece, in a nutshell, I'm convinced could actually convert masses of people to our cause, because it does, in 60 seconds, what we began our conversation on, rebranding the Democratic Party. In 60 seconds, it covers a century of liberal progress, and it ends with the most brilliant line, which is, not left, not right, but forward.
Mm-hmm.
America's party, the Democratic Party. And every chord of music and every frame in this piece is affirmative and makes you want to jump up and down and say, yes, I'm a liberal, I want to be with those guys.
That's excellent. Will you email me the URL? There's an email button on the website for the radio station.
Uh-huh.
Did Mary give it to you? The
Maybe she did. I'll go back and review the email. But one way or another, I'll definitely get you his website.
Great.
Because people need to see it, and they also need to then rattle Move On or the Democratic Party and say, this is the ad we want to run all October, because it's absolutely beautifully affirmative and is an anthem, really, of what this party and what you and I and our fellows have in our hearts and our spirits of what we want our government and our world to be.
That's
so true. I will definitely see to it that you get...
Yeah, and I'll put a link to it on my website. And
yeah,
this,
good.
This show will be archived on the website also if you want access to it after the 1st of September. So. But thank you so much.
Yeah, well, thank you for doing whatever you're doing. You know, we all got to figure our little bits and pieces, you know.
No,
if each one of us can convert one or two people, we're going to win.
Absolutely. All right. Well, be well, and it's great. It's great to meet you. Also.
Yeah.
All right. Take
Likewise.
Care. All right. Bye bye.
Ta da.
Okay, that was David Adams, and he and his collaborator Adam Klugman were one of the finalists in the Bush in 30 Seconds. Call for advertisements that MoveOn.org put out earlier this year. And so we were just talking to him, hearing about projects he's working on that he has worked on and where he's going. So that was great. Thanks so much. So now we're going to call Wade Nasanovich to hear about his commute.
Williamsburg, Brooklyn, to his day job at FIT. And again, every time I call an artist at their day job, I kind of think about that. Artists at our day jobs.
Hello.
Hey, Wade, it's Erica.
Hi.
Hi. Sorry I'm a little late.
Running over with Oregon?
Yeah, running over with Oregon is great. It's great. He was one of the finalists in the MoveOn.org, that Bush in 30 Seconds campaign they did. I don't remember what time of year it was, but I think it was earlier this year.
What competition was it?
It was MoveOn.org did a...
Oh, MoveOn, yeah.
Yeah, and it was the ad that was supposed to be aired during the Super Bowl. Not his ad specifically, but it was the competition for that ad.
Uh-huh.
And they were one of the finalists in it.
And
so I was talking to him about other projects he's done locally and that sort of thing. So it was great, interesting.
And what did he do? I mean, what was his did he direct it or did he write it or?
Well,
he
and his neighbor did the whole thing. I mean, it was put out to everyone, like anyone with iMovie, basically, you know, kind of thing. So they did the whole enchilada. Yeah.
The whole enchilada.
not half the enchilada, the whole enchilada.
Do you think the whole enchilada is in the Oxford English Dictionary? With origins coming out of California? First usage, whole enchilada coming out of California? Chico, coming out of Chico, California?
Chico, California. I'm impressed that you pulled Chico, California out of your...
I don't even know what Chico, California is. But that, I think Chico means small. Oh, so also means boy, but I think another, it means small. Is it small, Chico?
Chico Chiclets, right, is a small, you're asking really the wrong person. Although Chico, California, when I was looking at colleges 100 years ago, it was rated the top party school at the time by Playboy magazine.
By Playboy?
By Playboy.
You said it was the top partying school?
Yeah, you know how they do, like, whichever.
But it's funny because I just read this article in the Daily News about these anarchists are coming to New York,
mm-hmm.
and they mentioned this guy, and they said one of the top 50 anarchists. And I was like, how do they know? Like, how do they accumulate this information? How do you get to be a top anarchist? I guess they're on
reading.
Some list or something.
Maybe it's Playboy magazine again.
Rating
the top anarchists.
Yeah, the anarchists are really striving to be one of those top 50, and if you're in the cutoff, then it's like, why even be an anarchist?
It's brutal. It's ugly.
Who is this person in Oregon?
He is Mary Adams, the dressmaker's brother.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, and so I've heard lots about him over the years and his great activist interventions in his town, and so this was a great opportunity to actually talk to him about some of them. So it's really fun. He did, like, he's done all these yard sign campaigns and things. And he's
where does he live?
He is outside of Portland, Oregon. And yeah, he's
I think you can, like, ride a bike from downtown Portland to his place. Is this place really bucolic? It's so loud. I can't even. Sorry.
That's okay.
No, I'm standing out here across the street from FIT, next to 8th Avenue, and there's all this traffic. But every so often, if there's one, it's not so bad when it's just regular traffic. But if there's one sound or anything that adds to the general noise, it's really really hard to hear.
Yeah.
So what is it? Does Portland have suburbs?
I don't know. I mean, I assume so. Doesn't everywhere have suburbs? Don't suburbs have suburbs?
I just assume Portland was like a place like you could ride your bike out to the country in like 35 minutes.
Right.
And it would just be really nice, and you'd be like in a field of wildflowers, and
well,
you'd like to be deer out there. And
according to him, it's gorgeous where he is.
Really?
Lots of farmland. He has acreage. He puts together cars that people have. He puts together European sports cars that people have taken apart, thinking they know how to put them back together again, and figure out they don't. So they bring them to him, and he puts them back together, and that's what he does. I mean, it's kind of like amazing.
Is that like particular to European cars that people somehow feel that if it's a European sports car, they can do it? Like, they wouldn't do it with some other kind of car?
I don't know. I would have thought, you know, like, my whatever, listening in on other people, it's like people all talk about, like, taking Fords apart, and, like, I'd never take a European car apart. So, I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, I met a guy who did that with, I forget what kind of car, but he would restore them. And he just did it because, I don't know, he had access to a couple of junky ones. And he started fiddling around with that, and he figured it out. But, you know, I think if I did it, I would fuck it up so much that I would just quit within, like, 25 minutes.
Well, then, Wade, then you would go to David Adams with your box of parts, and he'd put it together for you, because that's what he does.
I'd say, yeah, but the whole car, I would have to put it, like, in a pickup truck. Or something.
Exactly. You bring it two boxes at a time in your car or on your bicycle.
But he just does it for fun or business?
Business. No, I think he makes a good living at it.
That's amazing.
Isn't
what the hell am I doing
it's
in a cubicle?
So creative and beautiful.
That is amazing. I know. Why is it that everyone but me can find their quirky autonomous professional way? I always think, like, I'm skillless. What could I do? There's nothing I could do to make money.
Wait.
What could I do? Do you want to come up with a business plan for me?
All right, I'll work on that. But almost every artist I'm calling in New York, I'm calling them at their day job. You know, it's like...
Yeah, that's true.
So get off this woe is me thing and tell me
no,
how
listen,
you
can. No, listen, I'm not getting off. Listen, I'm really happy to be employed. It's much better than, like, temping or something. And I have lots of, like, you know, if I were temping, I would really have to work much harder to get out of the office.
Yeah.
But I have lots of freedom doing this. No, I'm not saying I'm as woe is me, but it is, you know, there has to be something. I mean, maybe there isn't more to life than working in a cube for 8 hours a day. Not that that's a bad thing. Lots of people have worked in cubes in worse places. I mean, the thing is, I used to say I could be a coal miner. Like, at least I'm not a coal miner.
If
you're a coal miner, then, you know, that's tough. I mean, there was that whole spree of near coal mining disaster stories back a year ago or something, where it was really kind of in vogue to write about coal miners. Or those particular coal miners. It was out in Pennsylvania.
The ones that got stuck?
Yeah, I don't think they were, like, I think they were more, I'm trying to think, what are the different types of, what is the hard coal? It starts with an O. It starts with an A, it's anthracite. And there's anthracite coal, and there's something else. But they didn't do the anthracite as the hard coal, but they did soft coal. But I would not want to be the hard coal miner, although I'm sure it's just as hard to do coal mine the soft coal. Now, this is right here. I'm watching. There are lots of people like these two guys walking down the street,
uh-huh.
Like guys in casual clothes, anything from like shorts and t-shirts to like guys in corporate casual,
uh-huh.
Walking around with their Republican National Convention IDs.
Oh, really?
And they
already
have big, like, numerous IDs hanging around their neck. You would think they would conceal them. But they have probably some cachet in, like, having a Republican National Convention ID. I staked out the place this morning, by the way.
Okay, tell me about it.
I don't really have much to report. There's just lots of police and lots of mobile command units. Like, there's so many mobile command units. Which is funny, because they're all parked, so that doesn't really make them very, like, mobile command unit, I guess. But they have, like interesting-looking antennas and stuff. Antennas?
Uh-huh.
Did you say antennas, or did you say, like, antennae? Or is that just reserved for insects?
I have no idea. I don't know. You're the writer.
I have to look everything up. That's what's great about being a writer, because I'm wrong so many times, but I can look it up and write it the correct way. Also, you know, spell check helps. So when I'm speaking, I'm totally lost. So I don't know. I mispronounce words all the time, and it makes me very uptight. So I don't think it's going to. See, that's what happens, right? If you don't go to an Ivy League school, you don't hear all these people saying these complex words, you never learn how to say them. So you have many embarrassing moments in life where you mispronounce words. Two lively people. You still there?
I am. I'm asking Jeeves about antennae. But
who are you asking?
Jeeves. On the computer.
Oh, on the computer.
But it's not really answering me. I'm putting it in.
Like, it's antenna, A-N-T-E-N-N-A, and then plural, just add me. Is that right?
Yeah.
That's how I would think of it.
Okay. I've never asked Jeeves before.
What's another word that's like that?
What is the plural of antenna? Oops, I guess I should...
Does that really work?
I don't know. People talk about it, so I'm trying it.
I've only heard of it.
With plural, the spelling of antenna in plural... Special interest group webpage. All right, well, we'll see if this brings anything.
Oh, why don't you just look it up at dictionary.com? And type it in with an E on the end. Or you just type it in singular, I guess, not plural in those two.
Well, supposedly this is supposed to be talking about it, but... Proper grammar of minutiae's... Local.
Oh, yeah, see, minutiae, that's a word like it. Because minutiae, that's just automatically, you can't have one minutiae, can you? The minutiae, thinking of many, like, many small things. But that sometimes, I think you can spell that, that's spelled with an E on the end, or that nouns, or I, but I know there's an E in there on the end somewhere.
Well, I guess this is just an answer to it, because it doesn't talk specifically about it. But tell me more about what you're seeing around town.
Just that there is a lot of traffic on 8th Avenue. This morning riding my bike, there was a lot of traffic on 5th Avenue. And I don't know if that was just because they're redirecting traffic or not, but there's much more traffic going on the avenues going uptown.
So is people going to the convention, or is it like New York?
I just think it's that maybe it's rubbernecking or something, because it's pretty... involved setup, you know, right, on, you know, between the post office and the garden.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, there's all kinds of, like, I love this stuff when they make those temporary structures. Like, you ever, like, walk past construction sites and they have temporary structures built? Well, I love that kind of stuff. But there's, I mean, these are a little bit better than, the, like, construction temporary structures.
Uh-huh.
But they're, like, all kinds of, like, shacks. They're, like, really good, nice shacks.
Uh-huh.
And they're long. They're long, like, they're shaped like a shipping container.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Yeah, so they're, like, those kind of mobile things. That they're built for that, like a temporary office deal.
Yeah, but they have them, like, on steel beams and cinder blocks.
Yeah,
they're really sturdy.
Yeah, our public school around the corner has classrooms like that.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my God. Can you imagine if you had to, like, attending school is depressing enough. or like a kid, and then having to go.
Oh, I bet it's cool to go into your, you know, don't you think you get to go outside of the building and you walk across the playground and you go into like this other little box that's, you know, it's not depressing when you're six, I don't think.
I saw the teachers market it to the kids probably. Oh, it's special. You're so right. You're getting the annex.
It's depressing to the teacher, not to the kid.
Maybe. I thought it would be really depressing to teach in an annex.
Yeah.
That's why I'm glad I'll never teach again, because I'll never ever have to deal with teaching in an annex. Yeah, so anyway, so that's it. That's all it's important. And also, Diuto's will be open.
Your bakery.
Yeah.
Were worried they would not be open, or that you would not be able to get to it?
Yeah, I didn't know. I didn't know how much pedestrian traffic would be restricted. And I already saw, like, they're already telling people they can't park or stop at all on 8th Avenue from August 28th until the end of the convention. So it's going to be pretty cleared out, but I guess they'll allow pedestrian traffic past. I just thought there would be, like, it would be, like, cordoned off or something at a certain point, like at 32nd Street or something, or 33rd.
Mm-hmm.
And Diodas is north of that, or as north of 32nd. But I guess they'll let them, I don't know. I mean, I guess it's not a block away, isn't too close or something. But yeah, they're going to be open, so who knows? I do go there, but I always end up getting two things, so sometimes I don't go there. Because I know I can't resist getting two things.
What? And is it the same two things all the time, or?
It depends. Like, they have a deal, like a donut coffee deal for $1. I get that, and I get something else, too. Sometimes I get, like, a palmier, or they're really, really great cinnamon rolls with this, like, glaze on top, and then sometimes the center is almost a little undercooked, so it's really, really moist. It's, like, it's dense, you know, and it has little shards of nuts on the inside.
Oh,
that's really nice. And then I also have this, their signature donut/pastry is an apple fritter, and that's, like, this deep, fat fries, like fritter with apples in it, and then they put like a Dennis glaze. It's really, really good. But you eat a quarter of it and you feel so high in sugar. And I'll just eat the whole thing in one sitting, no problem.
Probably.
But you need an entire coffee. But that's not included in the donut deal in the morning. And then they also have like donuts, but I don't like their cream. The Bavarian cream it tastes really weird. Like they put like a liqueur or something in it. I don't know what it is about it. But anyway, did you read that article or that little thing about hot saucing your baby?
No, I didn't. I did not read it.
Or hot saucing your child as a disciplinary measure?
Yeah, no, I didn't read it. Was it put on that site as a joke, or it's earnestness?
Well, this is what's great. Yeah, you know, did you ever watch Facts of Life?
I did.
Okay, you remember Blair, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, Blair has come out with a child disciplining book.
Oh. Right?
And it's called, it's called Creative Something to Discipline Your Child. It's really horrible. And what hot saucing is like, if a kid is really bad, then you, like, put like, hot sauce on his or her tongue.
Uh-huh.
And then the kid knows, like, not to do it.
Well, we all didn't like Blair anyway. She was always the one that you hoped you weren't like.
Blair always looked like she was predisposed to, like, that kind of later, almost morbid obesity.
Yeah.
You know? So she, she didn't go into superstardom because of that. Like, she never would have had that super thin body that's required now. So, but although, the other one that was kind of chunky, who was, like, the self-deprecating one?
I remember Joe, Tootie, and Blair.
Judy?
Tootie.
Oh, Tootie, yeah. No, but it wasn't Tootie. It was another one. I don't know. But she is actually she's actually in another sitcom. She's like on a sitcom like in the WB or something.
Well, that's great. Good for her. Hey, tell me how you got to work today.
Oh, yeah, that's right. This
it depresses me talking about television for too long.
No, it depresses me that Blair probably has so much fucking money, and then Blair gets his book published that everyone's going to buy, because everyone wants, like, the child-rearing Rosetta Stone, right? So, like, they're going to buy it, and she's going to make even more money.
It'll be in the Daedalus Overstock
And then everyone is going to be putting like hot sauce on their kids' tongues. And there'll be all these kids who will never eat like Indian or Mexican food because they have such an aversion to hot food.
How did you get to work?
The commute was same commute. You know what I discovered though today was it's interesting that if I as soon as like the way I'm going to hit all the streetlights on the way is completely determined by my first 30 seconds once I'm in Manhattan.
Uh-huh.
So, like, if I have to stop at Essex Street and wait for the traffic, or wait for the light to change, because mm-hmm. It's really hard to cross on Essex Street unless the light is changed, because there's so much traffic.
Essex, always, what? Where are you crossing?
Essex and Galanti.
Uh-huh.
So if I have to stop there, then my commute is totally established. Like, I cannot go any other way, because then I end up going over to Bowie, and I have to stop there,
uh-huh.
Right? And then I have to, although in Soho, I could run a few lights, and that does change it. But it doesn't usually work that way, because there's still too much traffic to cross on the red light. But this morning, I came down the bridge, I jumped right onto Delancey Street, coming on, like, off the sidewalk, so I was kind of, like, going with, you know, in the traffic,
mm-hmm.
And I hit all the lights immediately. And then I hit all the lights going into Soho. And then it was like my whole ride was thrown off. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know how. I didn't know how to do it.
Because you were flowing.
No, I didn't know if I should pedal really hard or if I should go easy
right.
Just to hit all the lights. You know.
Right. So you're figuring that out when you get the lights. How to pace yourself.
Yeah, I guess it wasn't as interesting as I thought. I thought it might have been one of these like. I was having some kind of, like, Malcolm Gladwell moment where I was going to expose some mystery.
Well,
that we've always kind of, like, have felt or just known about, but we never really examined it.
Well, maybe it remains, it'll reveal itself.
What was that?
Maybe it will reveal itself, just not immediately. And not to me. Do you know what I mean? Maybe it's not going to reveal itself in discussion.
And then
I'll
write a book. I could write a whole book about it. What the structure that is revealed in streetlights. It really is amazing, those streetlights, isn't it? Like, how they time them all and how they must be computerized or something.
I think the thing that's amazing is that people pay attention to them. I mean, although they don't, increasingly I see people just running lights, just like, baldly, like they stop at the stoplight and go. But anyway, the amazing thing is that we all play by those rules. to me, that's the amazing thing.
But the thing is, like, if I didn't, is it okay then by your rules that I run the red lights on my bicycle?
I don't know. It depends on the day, in my mood, really.
I mean, seriously, if I can't run the red lights, then I might as well just take the train.
Yeah, no. I mean, of course. But if I'm driving and almost hit you, then it's not okay. Then I curse. But then. Or if I'm like walking across the you know, do you know what I mean? It's like when
I'm a pedestrian. That's a different thing. But also pedestrians, I'd say, words pedestrians out there, you really don't see cyclists at all. I've almost run into so many people because they just walk out into the street and they don't see you.
No, absolutely. We're all.
But then you want a little bit of kind of. I mean, just enough, like, what if it were so orderly and everyone stopped at every red light and all the traffic ran perfectly and
rules
are that's never going to happen, but.
The rules are meant to be broken.
But, you know, honestly, if you go to, you know, just in some of the cities, like, in, like, when I went to Caracas or Mexico City, like, it's really bad there. You have to really watch.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's.
So here, it's like, people stop. Like, that's incredibly humane
right. That
people will stop when you're, like, going through a crosswalk. Or you're even jaywalking, for that matter. What do you think about jaywalking?
But I think, you know, I'm going to talk to Mary about jaywalking because she's got some beautiful things to say about jaywalking, and then you can listen to it in the archives thing. But it's, you know, I think in New York, she and I talked about this, where she actually obeys the walk, don't walk, or tries to, because otherwise, like, we're always so torqued up. We're so torqued up to get where we're going, and it's, like, all about our little path within. And, you know, if you actually stop, you have to breathe, kind of check in with what's around you. I don't know. I do find that when I pay attention, and it's not so much about following the rules, it's more about, like, just chilling out. Do you know what I mean?
So even if she is just, like, walking in the East Village, and there was a don't walk, like, on a little, like, sleepy street.
Yeah. To stop, to really stop, and I mean, you know, then...
She does it all the time, or just, like, on select days?
She tries to do it all the time.
Oh, wow. I find that amazing.
Isn't that amazing?
Does she commute? Does she live in East Village where her shop is?
No. She lives in Chelsea.
Oh, she's the one who rides a bike from
She walks.
Oh, she walks.
Yeah.
And she stops from Chelsea all the way to the East Village?
Yeah, I mean, but, you know, like certain days, no, so.
Wow, that's amazing.
It is amazing. I think it's beautiful. Like, these different things to, like, slow yourself down in, like, the city that's all about speeding yourself up. So, I don't know. Whatever.
Yeah. I could never do that. I would, like, always want to strive for efficiency.
Yes. Yeah.
That shows amazing will.
Yeah, I just have another things to think about when you stop. I don't know. But I should go, Wade, because I'm going to call another one of the artists in the exhibition to talk to him about his video that's in the show and his... history of activist artworks. And the guy who did The Scream, did you watch that piece at the opening last night? Jim Cassano.
With the George Bush piece and the clapping?
Yeah.
And that guy?
Yeah.
Having an anxiety attack?
Yeah.
Yeah, I saw that one. I didn't watch the whole thing. It's kind of stressful.
It's totally stressful.
Yeah.
Anyway, so...
Okay, well, have fun, and I will... So now we're doing this on the weekend?
Yeah, we'll talk on Saturday about your commute tomorrow, since your schedule, since you can't get out in the afternoon.
Well, isn't the whole premise of this that it's my commute?
Yeah, so we'll talk about what your commute was on Friday, on Saturday. We'll just talk about it.
What about Sunday?
Sunday you're off.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you get the day off.
Okay, and then
unless you guys are going to the march, and then I want you to call in and talk about what's going on at the march.
Yeah, what is happening with the march?
It's happening, and I heard that the permit was denied yesterday, today, so for the park, so it's the West Side Highway, but I don't know if there's the opportunity for more appeals or what.
Well, what is the march that's supposedly going up, like 7th Avenue or 8th Avenue, and then it's going to cross on 34th and end in Union Square?
I don't know. There are many marches happening, and... I'm not sure. I'll send you, there's a really great Guardian article yesterday that talks about a bunch of different marches.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I'll send it to you. But so, I'll talk to you on Saturday again.
Okay. All right, talk to you then. Adios.
Thanks so much, Wade. Bye.
Oh, you're welcome. Bye.
Okay, so now we're going to talk to Jim Costanzo, who has a video piece in... up at Schroeder Romero Gallery.
This is Donna.
Hi, this is Erica DeVries calling for Jim Costanzo. Is he available?
I think you have the wrong number.
I have the wrong number. Okay, great.
Are you looking for area code 718?
212. Did I dial 718?
No, you dialed 212.
Yeah, okay. I'll try. I have another number for him. Thank you.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right. He's expecting me on his...
Erica?
Yeah, Jim. Hi.
How you doing?
Good, thanks. I tried your home number, and I probably wrote it down incorrectly, so I'm calling you on your cell.
We can continue. I can give you the right one. It might be a better connection on it. Is this okay?
Yeah, you sound great.
Okay.
Yeah. So, thanks for agreeing to do this. We're on the air right now.
Oh, okay.
And so, I guess, let's start with the opening last night and then move into your piece.
Okay.
How was it for you last night? Did you get feedback on the work? Did you meet the other artists? Did you already feel like you knew most of the other artists? Or?
Well, I knew quite a few of the artists there in the show. That means like four or five people that I haven't met before, some of whom I have admired for a while. And so it was a really nice evening for me. Seeing old friends and meeting some new people. And I did get some feedback on the work, which was positive.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a lot of people feel it's very timely.
Yeah,
and people have a different reaction to it.
Okay. Well, let's describe the piece first. I guess now that I'm listening to you, so people who are listening who haven't seen the show or can't see the show know what it is.
Okay. It's a 3-minute video, and the title is The Screen. The subtitle is 21st Century Edition. And obviously, it's a reference to Munch's piece, The Screen, which was just stolen over the weekend.
Speaking of timely.
Interesting coincidence.
Yeah.
And what the piece is basically me screening for 3 minutes, and I do screen behind me an edited version of George Bush's 2003 State of the Union address right before he started the war. And cut in with that are images from the early invasion of the war in Iraq. And the piece is, it's an accurate summation of my feelings, not only about the State of the Union and the invasion, but I've been involved in protests since his non-election in 2001. And I helped organize a demonstration in New York City against the inauguration, and then went down the next day to Washington when the actual inauguration was, and I was protesting there. And I'm older. I have a memory of Reagan Bush, and I remember when Reagan and George Bush the first were in office. We had Ron Contra, which is directly related to the 9/11 attacks, Osama bin Laden. But we also had death squads in Central and South America, which, of course, this was all tied together, they were selling guns and bombs and all kinds of things to terrorists. And it was all an interconnected type of thing, and it was just such brutality, and it was really a war. It was part of the Cold War, and it was really a hot war, especially for the people in Afghanistan. And I'd been through the Mideast, and I've been to Afghanistan, and I was always impressed with those people when I was there. So when Bush was running for office, I pretty much assumed it would be a continuation of all the things his father and Reagan did. And I wasn't surprised by anything that's happened in the last 4 years. But the election was just, to me, just such an outrage when you consider our history. And you think about the struggle with slavery, Jim Crow, segregation, and to have them effectively deny African Americans the right to vote, it was incomprehensible that it could happen in such a blatant way and that it would be ignored by the news media and people in general. So, that's really the heart of what the piece is about. It's not just about the war, because the war is terrible. What we're doing there, the whole idea of, we're going to go out and really go into a colonial state and forget imperialism and go back to this occupation of a foreign land because they have oil, of course it's an outrage. But all the things that he's been doing and led up to his administration was just an outrage, and that piece is a very strong emotional thing for me, and it's something that I'm very much tied into on so many levels.
Yeah, it's intense. The piece is intense, and I mean, there's so many things. Like, there's sort of sexual connotations. Also, I don't know if anybody else is.
I'm sorry.
I feel like there's sexual connotations also, especially watching it without the sounds. Like, there's that pleasure pain thing that's kind of uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And then, but then, you know, it's pretty clear within the context of the exhibition, the pain aspect. But I guess something I'm curious about is, because I was looking at your website, at some of your older projects, and I'm curious about, like, how you combine this deep root in activity in political activism and also in art making, and how you think about those things together or separate. What is, how do you... what's your process, I guess, is what I'm asking.
Well,
in
let me
to
go back very quickly to give a quick summation of my history, which is, it's not really a pun, but in the late 80s, I became involved with a group of artists, and we started making work we were called Repo History. We're an artist collective. We made site-specific public artworks that dealt with issues of race, gender, class, and sexuality. And the idea of getting out of the museum and gallery and preaching, and not preaching to the converted, but going out into the streets and making projects that would be evocative on any number of levels. And so I had 11 years of doing that. For me personally, my work has been involved with, political artwork. Along with that, I made multimedia installations when I was a member of Repo History. One was called States of Siege. It dealt with my personal experiences during the Tompkins Square riots, which was the mid-80s. The riots really continued into the early 90s, even after I left that neighborhood. I used to live across the street from Tompkins Square Park, and I was walking home through riot police. So
wow.
We were in a state of siege there. It was like 5,000 riot police on call. They could be there in 10 minutes, like up to 2 years after the initial riot in 86, I believe it was.
Uh-huh.
And so I made a personal work that talked about my relationship with that. But I also included a video that had the Rodney King riots and other riots and different things that were happening within the United States. And when I'm talking about, before I was talking about Reagan Bush 1 and Bush 2, I mean, this was all a period of time and up to the early 90s. And there were riots in the streets of America. The Rodney King, of course, was the most extreme example of it. But, you know, when the Rodney King riots happened, we had an African-American mayor, Dinkins, and New York City didn't suffer as much as some of the other cities in the country. And so, I was making work with Repo History, public artwork. I was trying to create work that explained my internal conflicts and contradictions of what was going on in my life personally, and also what was happening to the world in general. And also, the first Gulf War happened back then. And, you know, in kind of this stream of conscious way, I was connecting all those things together.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my work took on a different turn in the late 90s. As Repo History, we were kind of, coming to an end. We had an 11-year run, which is a really long and productive time.
Pretty amazing.
And we finally started winding down. I started making more personal work. But similar to the thing about the State of Siege was Tompkins Square Park, where I started doing a thing that I call a data bank, which was when I would go out and use a credit card or bank card, I would document it. I did this trip with my partner up to upstate New York and Vermont, New Hampshire, And so we got gas, when we went to a restaurant, we charged these things. I would make documentation. She would videotape me or take photographs or different things. And I would have the information from the credit card underneath the photographs. And of course, this was before the Patriot Act. This was in 98, I believe it was, when I started doing it. And it was published in 99. I was showing it around a little bit. But it was more kind of this internal thing, but it also dealt with identity, commodity, and all those things that those of us fortunate enough to be plugged into the world economic economy, we all deal with on one level or another. And, I also teach computer graphics, so the whole idea of what these things are, what these systems are, on a philosophical level is very interesting to me. So, I was doing all that, and then came the election, and I made a multimedia installation in 2002 based on my experiences demonstrating against Bush and also the war in Afghanistan. And we hadn't invaded Iraq at that point in time. And the piece combined my going to demonstrations with inane little things like, buying sandwiches to take on a bus down to Washington. Mm-hmm. So there's all this kind of different types of information mixed together. There was demonstrations against the WEF, and I was working with Indy Media. There was the whole section of things from the TV on war. And then there was another whole section that dealt with propaganda films like Black Hawk Down, and any number of different films. Around 2000, it was very obvious. People from the Bush administration went to D.C. went to L.A. and talked to people within Hollywood and actually said we need things that would be more supportive of what our agenda is, what we're trying to do. And then we started to get these war films that were coming out, and I think Black Hawk Down was the most obvious propaganda film, but there were all these other films like Swordfish, which was with John Travolta and I forget the other actor, I guess Halle Berry was in there, some other people. But there was all these films that were coming out, so I had a section that dealt with that and the news media that was very critical of what our corporate media is about and how it's interrelated. And it had photographs, it had video, and it had a wall of text that explained all the different informations of the data map. So, that's where I was coming from. And now in the fall, I'm going to have a one-person show at Salem State College that's going to be a continuation of the data map. And it'll be from the inauguration up until, I think I'm just going to cut it off now at the Republican National Convention here in New York City. Mm-hmm. And I've already I have quite a bit of that work done. I was at another show that was not quite as political in the early part of the summer where I just documented everything I did that day, including using a subway card, because if you pay for your subway card with a credit card,
mm-hmm.
your name and information is all embedded into the card.
Mm-hmm.
And when you swipe it,
mm-hmm.
they know where you are. Now, they have already arrested people by going through, by taking their subway card and saying, okay, you've been at, Bedford Avenue at 446 on Thursday, and you said you were someplace else, but there was something happened there and think you did it and you lied about it and here's a verification.
Mm-hmm.
But that's within the card. And that was years ago. And I think that what they're working on, and I don't know how, I haven't been able to find this out, but there's no reason that every time you swipe your card, if it has your name in it, that they can't automatically take that to a major database and know where you are and follow your movements.
Right.
So I have all these things, and I did a full month for the whole, for the exhibition. I just did every day, everything I did, whether I traveled, and I made a few short trips to visit my sister and to go to a christening up in Montreal. Mm-hmm. But if I stop and buy gas, and those, you know, all that, you know, Easy Pass, any of those things are just, it's data.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that, you know, I've been involved with political artwork, you know, very strong since 89, you know, I don't know what kind of records they would have on me.
Right.
But I would think that, you know, somebody knows who I am on one level or another.
Right.
And that work, and what I'm doing is it's just making it more public. Mm-hmm. And on some levels, you know, I feel that...
Sort of taking that back.
You know, what do I have to hide at this point
exactly.
anyway? You know, I've been doing this for quite a while. And, of course, the flip side of that, you have Steve Kurtz of Critical Art Ensemble, who is... well, I would hope most of the people would know, but anyway, his wife died at night, and he called an ambulance to come, and and when the people came in, they thought he had some kind of science experiment, and they thought he was a terrorist, and they found it was just all harmless things, but that he's up for mail fraud.
Right.
And he and another professor, Steve Kurtz, teaches at, I believe, Buffalo State University.
Mm-hmm.
He's taught at Carnegie Mellon, but basically for having this simple basic chemistry, they thought it was terrorism, which it's not, but it's very political artwork about genetic engineering, and so the vindictive way of going after him, and to set an example for other people, especially artists, of course,
right.
is to get him for mail fraud, and, you know, who knows if he'll win or lose, but I think most people think that the government can't win the case.
Right.
But they're going to stick him with a $300,000 bill for his defense.
Exactly, exactly.
So it's very complicated. And, you know, and the whole idea of what the data map is, again, it started off before the Patriot Act. But I think now most people understand that our whole lives, the computer is the most efficient form of surveillance that there is. You know, our phone records, all this data now, according to the Patriot Act, it just goes into one database. You know, your health records, all these, I mean, everything you do, your whole life. And some people say, well, there's too much information, you can't, you know, could they possibly go through it?
Right.
Well, that's, they don't understand how computers really work.
Right.
Because basically, the example I like to give is that Bill Gates and Microsoft were in a case, a monopoly case. The government sued them for being a monopoly. And, Bill Gates came in, he made all these statements, and I didn't do this, I didn't do that. And then the government came in and says, oh, Bill, you know, we have all your email here, and it said you did say this, you did do that.
Mm-hmm.
And if Bill Gates, who has some of the most brilliant programmers in the world working for him, if they can get his email...
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and the thing is, they can, you know, with the computers today, they can get, you know, months and months of the internet, plop it onto a hard drive, and then just keep searching at random.
Right.
You know, so they have all this information, you know, for years, and they can go back at any point and get what they want about any of us. They have things like Carnivore that, if you use the word bomb in your email, you know, all of a sudden it goes right to the FBI or Homeland Security.
Right.
And, you know, those kind of tracking devices.
Right.
So I'm trying, you know, the idea of the data map, which, you know, the screen is just one variation of that. I mean, I show all this stuff together.
Mm-hmm.
But the screen is just one variation of that. It's not really a variation. It's a tangential to that. So I'm trying to make these kind of things visible.
Speaking of visible, your billboard project is beautiful, and I was wondering if it's still up, the billboard in Jersey City.
I'm sorry, you broke up a little bit. Say that again.
Is the billboard still up?
No, the billboards, you have to rent them by the month.
Uh-huh.
And let me explain briefly what that is. I did a series of free billboards based on the ideas of freedom, peace, and justice. And those are the big, in large letter, they were on the billboard. The images behind, they are different images from the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, abstracted images. But clear enough, you can see what they are, like a helicopter, one person standing in a desert, and soldiers
attacking. I'm just going to interrupt
but
for a second.
But the text underneath them, underneath freedom, peace, and justice, was all the same. So it said one American equals one Iraqi equals one Afghan, one Israel equals one Palestinian, one Christian equals one Muslim equals one Jew, one world, one people. And I've working with a nonprofit, and I've been working with a Lake Box Gallery, and they've been really great in their support. And I've put up two of them so far. You get a discount if you work with a nonprofit. With somebody. Actually, I've been working with Viacom, who own Clear Channel, and been very hard on a lot of really good artists, musicians, basically. I put a lot of time thinking, coming up with something I thought that would be a strong statement, but something that no one really could argue with. That's all that experience I had with Repo History and other things about making public art. So I put up two. I'm hoping to put another one up in the fall. But what the main thing I would like to do now is I'm trying to raise money so that I can put a variation of the billboards on the side of buses for Washington, D.C. And hopefully I can do that in the fall also before the election.
I just want to say for people listening that you can see these billboards if you go to the RadioFreeErica.net website and then click the link to the exhibition, then go to the artist galleries on Jim's page in the artist gallery. There's all sorts of links to your different projects. So I'm looking right now as we're talking at these billboard projects on that link. So something I'm curious about, and I feel like, you know, I also teach, and I'm curious about, like, I think people are always interested to know, like, how did your art practice begin to intersect your political practice, or did they develop simultaneously, or that question?
Well, it was a gradual thing. I wasn't always as political as I am now. It seems like I've been getting more political the older I get, which is not usually the way it works. Not that I wasn't political before, but you know, when you go through art school, most people aren't encouraged to do work that is political. And so, you know, I'm older, and so when I was in graduate school, it wasn't, you know, the first thought of many people. Even though I was involved with photography and film, and the whole idea of the documentary would lend itself to that. But at that point in time, I wasn't really. I'm still not interested in pure documentary work. Or from an unbiased point of view, going out and taking this neutral point of view. I respect people who do that, and, you know, I think it's really important on many levels. I did a little bit of work with Indie Media for the WEF thing that happened in New York in 2002, and I'm a great supporter of theirs. I think they're, you know, just fabulous. It's not really what I do, but I was making work, and it was a kind of formal, and it dealt with different issues. And then, the longer I was in New York, the more I ended up hanging out with people who were thinking the way I did. And you meet people, and you start talking. You know.
Hello, Jim. I think I've lost you. Jim, if you can hear me, try and give me a call back. I'll call into you again.
Erica?
Yeah, hi, I lost you.
Yeah, the cell phones will do that.
So, you were talking about when you were a student and documentary filmmaking.
Well, I wasn't really into that at that point when I was a student.
Mm-hmm.
And I was more involved in fine art approaches and, you know, other formal issues.
Mm-hmm.
But the longer I was in New York, I started meeting more people that were I saw that art could be a lot more things. I didn't want to really be a documentarian on some level, so I felt, you know, I was an artist, a visual artist, and I wanted to take a different approach, a more personal approach to things. And then I met different people. I was working as a printer, and I saw a lot of the work in New York. It was very socially engaged. I printed for people like Andre Serrano, Louise Lawlers, Sandy Skoglund, Laurie Simmons, Sarah Charlesworth, a lot of the really great artists of the 80s, actually. I was very fortunate. A lot of conceptualists in the 80s. I was working for this little print shop, and we were doing a lot of their work. And, you know, that in the 80s, you know, to me, the best stuff going on there were the women were doing this incredible stuff. And other people were doing very good work, too, but it wasn't just feminist work. It was work that was really strong and transcended so many different levels, but they were all what I would call really strong women who had a very strong sense of self, and, you know, I mean, they were obviously feminists and on that level, too, but I wouldn't want to just say that they were feminist artists, because that wouldn't be fair. They were just great artists that were coming from a very specific point of, well, not just a specific point of view, they had multiple points of view. But anyway, I was fortunate enough to be involved in all that and meet these people, and I felt that, you know, I want my work to have a voice that would be more than just about formalism and about, different types of ideas.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a multiple, and actually Louise Lawler suggested I go to a town meeting at DIA that was being run by Group Material. And so through them, I ended up meeting Lucy Lepard and being part of this thing called Alliance for Cultural Democracy. And, of course, Lucy Lepard and Jerry Kearns, who's also in the show, were part of Political Art Documentation and Distribution, PAD. And so, you know, there's all these different lines. And, you know, I got to know Jerry and also Nora York, his wife. I knew Nora before they got together from the East Village. So, you know, you're running in this crowd. It's like, the usual suspects. And it was really, those kind of people were really a big influence on me. And I got to hang out quite a bit with Lucy Lepard. And Lucy actually she was almost like a member of Repo History, going to all of our early meetings and, advising us and helping us, form ideas and everything. And she wrote about us when we were first starting out. And she wrote the essay in our first catalog and all. And so it was a very heady time. It was a very interesting time. And we were probably incredibly naive, but we actually thought that we could use art as a way of changing things and changing, opening people's minds to different things. But, you know, on another level, I don't think we're really that naive, because when you think about it, Jesse Helms came out at the same time and attacked Andre Serrano, Mapplethorpe, and so many more people.